and welcome to Grad Chat, your opportunity to find out about graduate research here at Queen's. My name is CJ the DJ, and I am your host for this week's Grad Chat. Of course, a show like this could not happen without the support of the School of Graduate Studies and Postdoctoral Affairs, as well as CFRC. So thank you very much to both of them. Now, if your mates miss the show at any time, you can download the podcast the next day on either iTunes, Google Podcasts, Spotify or CFRC podcast. So no excuse not to hear what our awesome students and postdoctoral fellows are doing. Today, though, I would like to introduce you to Taylor Ray Morell, who is doing a PhD in geological sciences under the supervision of Dr. Laurent Godin. So welcome to Grad Chat, Taylor.
Thank you so much for having me on, Colette.
I've been waiting to hear this because you've got an interesting topic. And, Taylor and I were speaking the other day about what made us interested in certain areas while we were at school. And I say, no, geography always fascinated me. History always fascinated me and still does. And I think just in general, the environment and how we came to be here, et cetera, and what survived and what didn't. So for you, Taylor, what made you want to get into geological sciences?
It was kind of almost an accident how I fell into it. In high school and elementary school, I was that like history nerd that was always reading books about Canadian history and world history. And then once getting into high school, both my parents and a lot of my teachers were like, hey, maybe you should try out science.
Right.
And really push the natural sciences into a lot of us, like students in school who maybe liked school more than others.
And that was a nice way of putting it.
Who maybe put in more time than others. And so I quickly realized that I liked science, but it just didn't, like, biology and physics just didn't scratch that same itch that history did. And so in my grade 12 year at my high school, they offer something called Earth and Space Science.
Oh, okay. That would have been fun.
It was such a cool course. I took it for the space part of it.
Right.
And then kind of just fell in love with the rock part of it. And so I came to Queen's for my undergrad thinking I was going to go into life sciences, do something in the medical field. And I quickly realized that I needed to be outside.
Yes.
I needed to have a chance to get outside and explore and put my hands on what I was actually working on. And so I took a first year geology course, and the rest is kind of history.
I love it. And there's the history part.
Exactly.
A good combination.
Well, geology really, it's a science in itself, and it takes a lot of concepts from other sciences, looking at physics and chemistry and how it all comes together. But you're really studying the broad scale history of the Earth. So mm-hmm. rather than just limiting ourselves to human civilization, we're going back 4 billion years.
4 billion. It's a little bit different, isn't it?
The scale is a lot different.
Yes. Which actually, I'm going to flip straight to this. You were a guest speaker at WISE's Elementary School Day Camp for Girls. So first of all, what is WISE and what made you want to do that?
So WISE is Women in Science and Engineering, and it's a group on campus that puts together different events for elementary school girls, but also undergrad students or who identify as female. And they reached out to me as somebody who, like, I didn't really know what WISE did during my undergrad, but they reached out to me as someone who comes from a science background that is typically underrepresented in their guest speakers. And so I had the chance to bring in a whole bunch of samples and talk to a group of about 30 to 40 elementary school, like, aged girls.
Fantastic.
And they went crazy. They just love seeing all, like, the pictures of me being outside and
right.
not wearing, like, a lab coat, but rather wearing field clothes. They loved hands-on experiencing the rocks.
Right.
And then we put together this exercise of building mountain systems with Play-Doh.
Oh, fantastic.
And then so each group of girls kind of made their own mountain system, and then we combined it together to kind of represent what happens on the large-scale process of how continental or tectonic plates come together and pull apart.
See, that would have been fascinating at school. And I'm sure just from that one session, like happened to you in a similar way, that's enough to tweak these young girls' thoughts about, okay, well, maybe I could get into something like that? Or is there something along those lines that would catch my interest? Because if we don't know about it,
exactly,
then how are we to even consider it as an option?
And that's the main thing I think that really surprised me, was that geology was a viable employment opportunity.
Yes,
and it is.
It is.
It's a huge part of the Canadian economy too. So,
well, yeah, that's a good point actually. Mm-hmm. And I, probably people don't see the connection always.
No, not always. We as Canadians don't usually get to see that side of things unless you are you know someone, or you have a family member, or you're grow up in a more of a mining community. But if you're from Southern Ontario, where I mostly grew up, you're not exposed to it in the same way that you are to other sciences.
Probably the only way is when you go to your cottage or something and they've got the granite and
you know,
the granite sides. I think that's up at north of here, isn't it? Mm-hmm. Where they have more of the granite in the lake systems and things. And you think, oh, well, how did that happen? Well, actually, how did the Great Lakes happen? I mean, that still fascinates me, how much fresh water this country has.
I think a lot of people, when they see like granite outcrops by the side of the road, they're probably like, oh, that would make a great countertop.
Yes. Yes, good point. Instead of saying, why, how old is that?
Because
you can see sometimes the strata layers.
Exactly.
And that's always fascinated me.
Yeah, the rock types change and stuff. So.
Yeah, I remember going out at my grandfather's place in Gloucestershire, England, and his walls were all made of stones and things, and there'd be fossils in there and all sorts of things. And you think, oh, how old is that?
How did that get here?
How is that being crushed in this rock? My grandfather didn't like me sort of chipping out his wall, but there you go. But it did get me interested. Mm-hmm. Now, you mentioned the word tectonic plate, so let's get on to your research topic. And for everyone, I love this. You know, Taylor was very good at giving me the formal thesis title and the sort of title that we would probably better understand. And so the formal thesis title is Upper Plate Expression of Reactivated Basement Structures During Orogenesis. I hope I got that right. Mm-hmm. A Multi-Origin Comparison. And so I was having to get the Google, Mr. Googly out for that one, and Mr. Wikipedia. In plain language, though, it says, exploring the different pieces of evidence in the rock record that indicate pre-existing faults in the plates involved in tectonic collision moved during mountain building processes. Mm-hmm. And so we all know, well, I think most of us know, that mountains are made by certain plates pushing up against each other and then going up into these peaks. Mm-hmm. Which, of course, there's some bigger peaks than others, or maybe they were big and they've just eroded away right now. So why, first of all, why for you the fascination with tectonic plates?
I think the fascination started when I was learning about the continental drift hypothesis, which Alfred Wegener put together once he realized that the outline of South America and Africa fit perfectly together.
Oh, did I? I didn't realize that.
Yeah, so it's the Atlantic Ocean started opening at the end of kind of disrupting the Pangaea supercontinent. And so if you restore the Atlantic Ocean together, North America used to fit into Europe and South America used to fit into Africa.
Oh.
And I that's just so cool.
There's
just puzzle pieces on our planet that show what was going on previously, millions and millions of years ago, and that we can still track that through to today. And the fact that they move around on such a grand scale that we can only really start to understand that when we're looking out from above. But once we dig in deeper, we can find very specific pieces of quantitative evidence of how they
work
together.
So this rock is in one continent, but it's also in the other, dated at exactly the same time.
Yes, and fossils as well, different on South America and Africa. They've found the same fossils, indicating that they were conjoined at a certain point. And so just seeing that these tectonic plates, which are massive, like bigger than anything that we can really understand, move around through geological time, like they're just moving simply like lily pads on a lake.
And that's a nice way of putting it.
And crashing into each other and then creating these huge mountains with like high elevations and really, really cool rocks.
So just backing up a little bit, you said, mm-hmm. you know, South America and Africa continents fit together. Mm-hmm. But that's the top end. As we know, if you think about icebergs, most of the stuff is underneath.
Yes.
Mm-hmm. So that fitting is purely the top, not looking at what's underneath, mm-hmm. below surface.
Yes. And so the Earth is kind of divided up into different layers. So what is exposed on the surface is known as the lithosphere, or also known as the crust of the Earth. And then underneath the lithosphere, it extends pretty deep. And then underneath that, you have something called the asthenosphere, and that flows. So it's not as rigid as our lithosphere on the surface of the Earth.
So more like lava underneath.
More like lava. There's a little bit of a molten component, right. And they differentiate between the lithosphere and the asthenosphere based on how heat can move through it.
Okay.
And so in the lithosphere, a heat moves through conduction. But in the asthenosphere, it moves through convection. So you have these convection cells moving in the asthenosphere and then underneath in the mantle that can move these continental plates, the tectonic plates on the surface in the lithosphere around and cause them to crash into each other.
It's a bit scary.
Yeah. I mean, nothing
like,
that we
like
have to
some of those
worry
movies.
About,
but... no, diving down, drilling down.
Drilling, yeah, into the core. That movie is not very scientifically accurate, but it is
a
good time. It is a good time to watch.
I love it. So you're looking, though, at mountain belts, mm-hmm. around the world.
Mm-hmm.
Yes.
Yes.
Any ones in particular?
Two in particular. So I do most of my research in the Himalaya. Yes, in Southern Asia. And I also do some research in the North American Cordillera in actually Idaho. So in the northwestern U.S.
Why did you pick those two?
So the Himalaya is absolutely spectacular natural laboratory to study mountain building processes because it's so young. India really only crashed into Asia about 50 to 55 million years ago, it's not old at all. It's a baby mountain system. And so there's a lot of these processes, evidence of these processes still preserved because it hasn't been overprinted by a subsequent mountain building or extension event. And then I chose the North American Cordillera because there's a lot of architectural similarities between the Himalaya and the northern part of the North American Cordillera, in the sense that there are these basement faults that exist in... So in my research, in our lab group, we define basement faults as pre-existing crustal weakness in one of the continental plates involved with the collision.
So does that mean that's more susceptible to other things happening?
Exactly.
Okay.
In geology, rocks are kind of lazy. They like to exploit previously existing areas of weakness.
Which makes sense. Yeah.
Exactly. If it's going to be easier to go one way, choose the path of least resistance.
Right.
So when two continental plates collide, if the stress systems are well suited, they can cause reactivation, so movement on these basement faults again. These basement faults can be from pre-existing, like really, really old mountain systems. So we would call those sutures, where the mountains over top have been eroded away over millions of years, and we're just kind of left with this glued together two pieces of continental crust. They can be from different extensional systems that pre-exist, or they can be, a lot of different things, but yeah, mostly sutures.
I'm going back to thinking about ice again, because...
is actually a great relationship
to show, because when you're talking about tectonic plates or the mm-hmm. ice crusts, there's either you talk about some finding the weaknesses, right? Mm-hmm. So ice or rock. So the plates can either go one on top of the other.
Mm-hmm.
If one goes on top of the other, it'll affect something. Or if they both are just as strong, mm-hmm. is that when it pushes up to mountains?
Yes. So there's a couple different types of continental collision is what we call when there's two continental plates that collide. There's also oceanic continental collision, mm-hmm. which is exactly actually what's going on right now on the western margin of South America.
Okay.
Where you have the Pacific plate under thrusted, so going beneath the South American continental
crust. So that's going under. Okay. And they're worried about that one, aren't they?
Yes. Well, it's still quite active. And whenever there's movement, it causes these big earthquakes, which we hear about quite frequently in South America. And it also causes the buildup of the Andes, which are a combination of uplift and volcanoes. So there's a lot of active volcanoes down there. And then that also leads to a lot of interesting different mineral deposits that produce a lot of economic potential down there too.
It's funny how we always go to economic potential as opposed to the beauty of what yes. we've just seen.
The beauty or the
destruction.
The destruction, the beauty, the power, the geographical implications of what the Andes do. So the Himalaya is different from the Andes in the sense that it's the result of India crashing into the southern part of Asia.
Right.
And so when the two continental crusts collided, it did, like, there was not a huge buoyancy difference in terms of continental crust is more buoyant. It's so therefore it usually sits higher, and it's also
right.
usually much thicker than oceanic crust, which is usually thinner, more dense, just based on the mineral composition of oceanic versus continental crust. And so when India collided with Asia, there was less of a buoyancy difference between the two different pieces of continental crust. Which is why it pushes up, yeah. So there's still a little bit of overriding where the Indian plate is ultimately being forced underneath the Asian plate, but it does kind of scrape off everything that's on top of India to pop up these mountains.
If there's this tectonic plate shifting, mm-hmm. this is where you see lines of volcanoes and things.
Yes.
And there's that ring of fire, is that in the Pacific?
Mm-hmm, the Pacific Ring of Fire.
And that's where those two plates are joining.
Mm-hmm, that's where the
shifting.
Shifting. We're mostly in the Pacific Ring of Fire. It's mostly the Pacific plate being subducted beneath the continental plates around the Ring of Fire. And when you have a subducting oceanic plate, as it descends underneath the lithosphere and then in towards the cenosphere, it undergoes a lot of melting, which releases all the volatiles. So all the water and the gases that had been trapped in the oceanic crust releases it up. And then because of that buoyancy difference again, it rises into the upper lithosphere, melting everything as it moves up.
Right.
Therefore, creating all those volcanoes, which are spectacular.
So we know you're looking at the Himalayas and the mm-hmm. Caldera in Iowa.
Yes, Idaho, yep. Yes.
What are you actually looking for?
So using geophysical geophysical methods done by many different researchers, that's not my area of expertise, have identified these pre-existing basement structures in the underthrusted continental crust. So in the Himalaya, that would be the Indian crust. And
yes.
it contains these basement faults that just represent the entire history of India before it even thought about colliding with Asia.
Oh, okay.
So these basement faults date back to the Precambrian, so well over 500 million years ago. And they're oriented at almost 90 degrees to the mountain system front.
Okay.
So they are then projected northwards underneath all of that elevation buildup, but still within the underthrusted Indian plate. And we've, in our lab group and other researchers around the world, have identified that while when India underthrust beneath Asia starting about 50 million years ago, there have been periods of reactivation. So where these basement faults then move kind of like piano keys.
Right.
So they kind of end up segmenting the overlying origin, because once that piano key is depressed or released, moving that basement fault, it ends up affecting what's going on in the overlying mountain system as it evolves. So you can kind of think of it as the princess and the pea.
Oh, so you've got all these analogies. I love it.
So in the princess and the pea story, just a brief synopsis is that basically they're trying to figure out if this girl that shows up in the middle of the night kind of like drenched in rain like we are today, is a princess or not. And so they have her sleep on a stack of mattresses, but they put a singular little green pea underneath one of the mattresses at the bottom. She wakes up in the morning and she shows that she has a bruise from sleeping on the uneven bed because she truly is a princess. If you think about that in terms of my research, I'm looking for that bruise, that piece of evidence in the overlying mountain system that shows that there was a green pea, or in my case, a basement fault reactivation, influencing how the mountain system evolves over top of it.
Because that was going to be my next question. I mean, to be able to see what's going on, you have to drill down. So how far are you drilling down? Or is it evident on the surface?
It's so I work mostly on the surface, and it works out really nicely because despite the Himalaya being so young and having some of the highest peaks in the world, it undergoes a lot of erosion because of the Indian monsoon each year.
Right, right.
So the monsoon comes in and brings a whole bunch of rainfall, and then it erodes away in the rivers. So there's a constant turnover of new rock being exposed at the surface. And so the rocks that I work in specifically are metamorphic rocks, and these were at deep crustal depths as little as 25 million years ago. Oh. And so quite recent. It's as a side note, my friends all think it's very funny that I deal with such young rocks, because they're dealing with like rocks from Canadian rocks in the Canadian Shield are quite old, and so they think that it's funny that I'm dealing with such baby rocks, but such minor rocks. But no, I look at the metamorphic rocks that were exposed at these depths of 25 to 30 kilometers deep at these certain times, and then that they have been moved and exposed to the surface,
right,
prompted by the erosion and the continued collision.
So is the erosion happening fast?
It's
because if you think about how old those rocks are, that takes a fair amount of washing.
Yes,
to erode. And I wonder, with climate change and all the pollutions and things, pollutants in the world these days, has that fast-tracked it? I mean, is that the kind of thing that you can tell at this point?
I'm not sure if we'd be able to determine at this point the influence of climate change and how we've, like humans have changed the composition of the atmosphere on erosion rates. But
right.
I do know that the erosion rates are pretty substantial compared to, say, here in Kingston. So.
Right. Mm-hmm. That's a bit worry. So that's what you're doing in the Himalayas. What about in the Cordillera?
Well, in the Cordillera, it's very similar, that they have these basement structures or basement faults that are also oriented at really high angles, so almost 90 degrees to the mountain system front. And so a lot of geophysical imaging has been done through like the 80s and the 90s in Alberta, showing that there's these huge, like kilometer wide structures that then look to be projected into and underneath the North American Cordillera. So I chose Idaho as my research area to compare what we've learned and what we've come up as a hypothesis for what's going on in the Himalaya, and see if that can also be applicable to different mountain systems. So the North American Cordillera is similar in some ways of architecture. It's also different in the sense that it's what we call mostly as an accretionary origin.
Which means
it, instead of having just one giant continental collision like between India and Asia, it was a series of smaller, thinking about island chains or smaller pieces of continental crust accreting through time.
Right.
So it's kind of like you're stacking different pieces of Lego onto the side of North America.
Okay. So, because when I think about mountain ranges, I think most are either close to the waterline or the seas or somewhere smack in the middle. And you think, well, was that millions and millions and millions of years ago, or billions probably, was that still two plates joining and then started to create this new landmass, the continent itself?
So for example, the Canadian Shield was created over millions and millions of years of continental collision or continental accretion together to form that stable craton that we love to go and visit up north of Sudbury. And so when we're looking at these mountain systems that we can actually climb up to high elevations, those represent younger versions of what we would have expected to see in, say, the Grenville north of Kingston or into more of the Canadian Shield further north. And so the reason why we kind of see mountain systems normally close to bodies of water or oceans is just simply because there's either been spreading happening, creating that ocean, or there's been this accretion of oceanic or pieces of continent in oceans that have been accreted onto the side of larger bodies of continental crust.
Because I'm going away from your topic here, because I know, like in Australia, we have something that's called the Great Dividing Range, which is nothing compared to, I mean, it sounds awesome, but it's minute compared to other mountain ranges. And it is close to the coast. And then the rest of the country, there's nothing there other than the odd boulder, like Uluru and things like that. So I would have thought that would be a fascinating one to look at. You know, why have we got this here, but then not anywhere else? And it was there, but it all eroded.
That, I mean, the north of Kingston is an area called the Grenville. And a lot of researchers over the years have kind of used the Himalaya as a modern day, quote unquote, analog to what the Grenville would have looked like.
Oh, is that right?
Millions of years ago.
Right.
And so when we go and we look in the Grenville, we're looking at kind of the roots of a massive mountain system like the Himalaya.
Right.
And obviously there's much debate about that, as there's much debate over everything, but it's nice to think about that sometimes you can use like some like moderate versions of comparison between different mountain systems to think about what the scale that you're looking at.
Right. So what are you hoping to get from the two that you're studying?
So I'm hoping to see if what we've established and what we can notice in a younger, less overridden system as the Himalaya, if we can see, are these processes that we've identified happening, do they happen in other systems?
Right.
So the North American Cordillera is different in the sense of mostly accretionary origin. It's also slightly older.
Right.
And so it's undergone some subsequent processes called extension. So that's kind of where the plate direction that was colliding into it, kind of prompting that motion, it changed. So then there's some extension going on, overprinting what had originally happened during the buildup of these mountains. And so it's kind of having to peel back through different layers that we don't have to think about in the Himalaya because it's so pristine, it's so young. And seeing
it's more exposed, you can see it.
It's much better exposed. Mm-hmm. And so if we can see these processes happening also in different mountain systems.
Mm-hmm. And how are you going with that?
The research is still ongoing.
Because you're in your end of your third year, coming into your fourth?
I just started my third
year.
And so my field work is all done. So I've done two field seasons in the Himalaya and kind of 1.5 field seasons in the North American Cordillera. I say half because the first year was just a reconnaissance mission. And then I did the full field work this past May. And so now I move from fieldwork planning, which is so much fun, into looking at doing some lab work now to nail down time constraints on when these metamorphic rocks were being metamorphosed, at what conditions. So how hot and how much pressure were they under when they reached those peak conditions?
So you brought rocks back with you?
Oh, so many rocks.
You're so happy about that. Rock candy, just the real rock.
The real true rocks. And we have to do this thing called a beauty contest, actually.
Oh, really?
At the end of our field seasons, just because you want to bring back all the rocks that like you see based on interest, based on location, based on just simple aesthetics. And so we lay them all out on the floor and I have to go through and kind of play like America's Next Top Model with my rocks to see what rocks get to come home and what rocks I have to leave behind, because ultimately at the end of the day,
that's a bit sad.
It is so difficult. It's like trying to part with your children, but at the end of the day, you can't bring all the rocks home and you can't do all like research funds are a constraint. So you have to choose the rocks that you think will have the best possibility or probability of giving you more information than other rocks.
Well, you clearly like field work.
Yes.
I mean, unfortunately, you have to come back and do the other part, the analysis and the writing. So what was your favorite part of the field research, other than gathering the rocks and then unfortunately having to choose which ones come home?
I think my favorite part of the field research is that the research really comes off the page and comes alive when you're out into the field. Mm-hmm. So I started my grad studies at the master's level at the beginning of COVID.
Oh, so you couldn't really do anything
exactly.
other than read books.
Exactly. I was supposed to go to Nepal to do some research in April of 2020.
Right.
And so about 3 weeks before we were set to leave, the whole world shut down. And so I was like, okay, well, this is only going to last 6 weeks, right?
I thought too.
Right? Famous last words.
Yes.
And so I started my grad studies, and my supervisor, and I have a co-supervisor at the INRS in Quebec City as well. They have been so great about supporting me through COVID. And they had a suite of samples in a drawer that I could start working on.
So you can just have a look.
Exactly. Mm. From that same river valley, actually, I was going to go to in Nepal. So I started that research, started looking at those samples and really digging into the literature and reading all about these rocks and these landscapes and looking at previous pictures from different research expeditions. And eventually the project kind of just ballooned into realizing that like this can be expanded beyond a master's.
Right.
And so I with their support upgraded to the PhD project.
Fantastic.
Kind of taking in a larger area, regional area of what to explore, and then bringing in that that comparison to the North American Cordillera. And so when I finally got to go to the India Himalaya in 2022, Colette, it was
like, she was sold.
It was simply the most magical thing I've ever experienced in my life, just between getting to go and see the rocks and see the structures that I had spent months reading about in my bedroom while we were all locked down, and getting to experience firsthand going and doing field mapping. So we go to different stations and we identify what kind of rock it is.
Right.
We identify any structures, so whether there's folding or any minor faulting. And then we take the samples. And just also doing that at the same time as being in India, which is such a beautiful place, both geographically and culturally.
Right.
It was simply, I think I'm probably the luckiest grad student ever.
You clearly have to be in the field, don't you?
I love being in the field, yes. It's you wake up every day and you're going to see something different.
Right.
And
that's exciting.
And exactly. And so the first year I was in India, we mostly stayed in just different motels in around more populated areas. And so every day we woke up and we drove somewhere different and we saw different rocks. And then my second year, I went back last year and we did a 13-day trek up to a elevation of 3,500 meters.
Awesome.
Yes, very cool. So that one was equally as cool in a different way, because each day we'd wake up, we'd pack up camp, and we'd walk.
Move. Right. And we've got a lot of things to pack. And if you're collecting samples, that gets a bit heavy, doesn't
it? Yes. Well, we had a absolutely great trekking team.
Right.
And we had 6 mules.
Oh.
Along for the ride. So they carried all of our supplies. They carried all of our food because we needed to bring all that food up.
Animals are awesome.
The mules were simply like fabulous. And it was actually really funny. So each night we'd get to our campsite and we had 5 team on our trek, and then my field assistant and myself. And so we had two men manning the mules, kind of that was their job. And so they would let them out to graze every night after taking
Fantastic.
Off all of their weight off
Big
their back. And the mules wear like a little bell around their neck. And so we're at this one area, and in this valley, it used to be well populated before some political differences between India and China, and then people moved out of the valley. And so we were staying in this abandoned village, and it was about 7 o'clock at night and completely dark, because it gets dark very early in the mountains. And we realized that we can't hear
the bells
anymore. And so we're like, where are the mules?
Are they okay?
Are they okay? And so our mule men go looking along kind of the path that we had been traveling, and they can't find them. So we're like, okay, we'll just wait until the morning. We're not going to move camp tomorrow. We'll just walk up the valley as far as we can and then come back for that evening. So we walk out and that next day, and we do our field work, and we're mapping and looking at samples and stuff, and we come back to our campsite and they still haven't found the mules yet.
Oh no.
And I was like, oh no. Yeah. this was our furthest north of the valley that we were, and I was like, all right, I guess we'll just stay here for a bit. Not gonna panic. The key in field work is to never panic. Something's always gonna go wrong. Yeah. But eventually, so it was over 24 hours later that we found the mules. They had just wandered up a little bit further up the valley and then wandered up into kind of a stream area and were just grazing. Oh, and
they're thinking, it's great up here.
Exactly. And I was like, man.
They wanted a day off. That's what they wanted.
The mules unionized. Yes. And went on strike for a day. But I think the part I really like about fieldwork is that it's so unpredictable.
Yes.
You never know what is going to happen, whether it's your mules or you get a flat tire or it pours rain all day. And so you have to constantly be flexible in the sense of meeting your scientific objectives because you are there working to do a job, but also making sure that your entire team stays safe, stays healthy, and stays happy. So.
Well, I think you have to get it back out there. Because that's clearly your forte, and then, you know, pass all those samples on for someone else to analyze and write up about and make predictions.
Well, I do enjoy the writing up part too. So it's not as exciting in the sense that, like, yes, you wake up every day knowing what's going to happen, knowing that you'll be sitting there for a while, but it's so beautiful to see, like, to finally make sense of everything that you might have been confused about in the field, come back and figure it out and have that light bulb moment.
Well, that's good.
Yes.
That is very good. And I think that's probably a great place to stop. Taylor, fascinating. And you clearly love what you're doing. Oh. And I love it when I see grad students with smiles on their faces and they're clearly enjoying their work, which is fantastic. So best of luck with the rest
Thank
of
you.
It.
Thank you so much.
In the next 2 years are probably going to go really fast for you with all that analysis, because you've probably still got a lot of rocks to analyze.
No, a grad student's work is never done until that thesis is handed in.
Exactly. So. And then you go on to the next project. So.
Exactly.
So that's good. But I really do appreciate you coming on and explaining a little bit more about geology and tectonic plates and exactly the part that you're playing in it all to helping us understand what goes on.
Thank you. Thank you so much for having me on. It's been a blast.
Fantastic. Awesome. So that's it, everyone. Another week of Grad Chat sadly comes to an end. Don't forget, you can download the show tomorrow from either iTunes, Google Podcasts, Spotify, or CFRC Podcast. Just type in Grad Chat. Until next week, this is CJ the DJ signing off with a big hooray.
Thank you for listening to this podcast produced at CFRC 101.9 FM at Queen's University, situated on the traditional territory of the Anishinaabe and Haudenosaunee peoples, and brought to you by the generous support of the Faculty of Engineering and Applied Science.